This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. It's our full hour of national politics with looks at the latest from the White House, the Democratic presidential primary, and other issues of national significance. We're joined today by the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Michael.
And we've also got alongside us WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for coming in, Howard.
Thank you.
As always on the Political Junkie Show, we start with a trivia question. Ken, what is this month's question?
Well, there was big interest, is national interest, in Mitch McConnell's campaign for re-election next year. As you may know, Mitch McConnell is the longest-serving Republican Senate leader in history. Whose record did he surpass?
So Mitch McConnell broke the record
longest
of this
serving.
Person, and we want to know whose record Mitch McConnell broke as the longest-serving Republican Senate leader. You can call in your answer at 513-419-7100. Operators are standing by at 513-419-7100. Ken, tell them what they'll win.
They will win an absolutely valuable Political Junkie button that on eBay itself has gone for over, the last time I looked, 75 cents.
Wow. The phones are already blowing up. We're very excited about this. The number again is 513-419-7100, not just to answer that trivia question, but also to join our conversation. We've got so much to talk about. We are going to talk a little bit about that Mitch McConnell race next year because there have been some interesting developments on the Democratic side. But first, I'd like to start by talking about the president and the news media, because I feel like this issue shapes just about every other topic we'll discuss today. You know, the president called fake news on several stories this week, including one by the Washington Post that detailed White House aides saying that Trump told subordinates to move forward with building the border wall, even if it means committing crimes, promising them a pardon. He says that wasn't true. But then you have MSNBC political commentator and host Lawrence O'Donnell reporting that Trump's business loans from Deutsche Bank were co-signed by Russian oligarchs. And then O'Donnell had to later apologize for this report. It was single-sourced. It did not go through the traditional NBC News verifying list. What happens when Donald Trump pushes back as fake news against stories that are legitimate, that are fact-checked, and that are supported? And then you have this one example of something that, like, Lawrence O'Donnell has done, where a story may have some questions.
It just does damage to the entire industry. I mean, it is really unfortunate. Lawrence O'Donnell ought to know better.
It seems like there's a bar for President Trump and his level of fact usage, and then a different level for the traditional news media, because the president has, it's well documented that he's told many falsehoods over the course of his administration.
Right.
And although he may call a lot of the stories fake news, that doesn't necessarily make them fake news. But one story that comes out this week from Lawrence O'Donnell, and Ken, I'd like to get your perspective on this. You know, if Lawrence O'Donnell has to apologize, as he's done, for reporting on what he reported and the way that he reported it, what does that do to the news media, and how does that help the president?
Well, it definitely hurt. It definitely helps the president. I mean, the president, who has been talking about the media being the enemy of the American people, the fake news, the lies they've come out of there. First of all, Michael, I think you've been a little generous to the president when you talk about falsehoods. I would go far as saying he lies. He has lied, and he has continued to lie through much of his presidency. And that's painful. It's a tough word to say, and it's painful to say it, but I don't know how else to say it. I think he knows exactly what he's doing when it comes to truth and falsehood and lies. Having said that, any journalist worth his salt knows that you never go on the air or go in print with something that is single sourced.
Right.
And to say that, you know, he came up with he got a source that said that the bank, that the loans were co-signed by Russian oligarchs. I mean, first of all, Trump eats that up because we the media should know better. And what Lawrence O'Donnell did, and I agree with Howard completely, it did the media a great disservice, because much of the country distrusts the news media anyway. And anything, I mean, look, Donald Trump will never admit a mistake. He will never say, I'm sorry. He will never admit a fault. And the media seems to go out of its way to almost self-flagellate itself. Self-flagellate itself. That's great English. But the Department of Redundancy Department, exactly. But I mean, the fact that once, oh, Donald says, oops, I made a mistake, that's exactly fodder for Trump and those who do not trust the media.
Why, you know, it's one of these things that it's very basic journalism, but they are so crazed about trying to get something out there about Trump that makes Trump, you know, look bad. Now,
and they don't have to search that far.
And you don't have to search
why
it far.
Make stuff
yeah, that's
up?
Right.
Right. Right.
So let's
skip
the.
We talk about the lies. I mean, there have been thousands of them.
There's been a lot. There's a running tab on the lack of truth that has come out of the White House on a variety of issues. And just this week, the president did lie about how much money has been sent to Puerto Rico to deal with the hurricanes. It's a fraction of the number that he's tossed out. The story about Deutsche Bank is that through the federal court process, it is now known that Deutsche Bank has implied that it has some tax returns that likely belong to the president. The name was redacted, but it seems to be implied that these tax returns are the long sought after tax returns belonging to the president. And one of the investigating committees in the Congress is looking to get their hands on this. And Lawrence O'Donnell tried to advance this story with an exclusive report that he knows that the tax returns or that the bank loans that came from Deutsche Bank were co-signed by so-called Russian oligarchs. And that has not been verified by NBC News. And Lawrence O'Donnell did apologize for that. I also thought it was interesting this week in the context of what we're talking about, the president and the media. It's been a strange ride watching a president obsessed with ratings. But I guess that's what you can expect from someone who comes from the entertainment industry where it's competitive in that respect. He loves to champion Fox News and their ratings as the top-ranked cable news source. Well, he turned on them this week. Ken, what does it mean when the president says Fox News is no longer working for us?
Well, yikes. I think the word is yikes. Even Britt Hume, the loyal Fox commentator, went on Twitter this week and said, Mr. President, our role is not to support the president of the United States, it's to give the truth. But I mean, even Fox News is just, you know, whipsawed when they saw this. But the obsession about the ratings is a very good point. And to me, this is the ultimate thing. When Donald Trump was in El Paso, following the horrific shootings. Mm-hmm. He goes there and he's visiting people in the hospital and he's talking to the doctors who are taking care of the people who survived that awful, horrific attack. And he says, you know, I was here in El Paso not that long ago and I had a rally and it was a great rally and I got far more people than Beto O'Rourke got. And while he's ostensibly in the hospital trying to console the doctors who are seeing some terrible, terrible victims of gun violence, he's talking about the people who showed up for his rallies and comparing it to Beto O'Rourke, who's a former congressman from El Paso. So this obsession is... I'm a psychiatrist. I play one.
All right. So we're probably having a little bit of technical difficulties with Ken's connection, and we'll try to reconnect that. But on that point, I mean, the president is so easily irritated, and he reacts to things that, I mean, I guess anybody as a human may feel something when somebody says something about them or there's negative reports. Right. But it seems I can't say it's unpresidential. I don't want to take that position. It's just not in the tradition of the way a president behaves.
Yes. I mean, it is unpresidential. I mean, there is a certain amount of dignity that comes with that office and that you can take that kind of criticism and not feel that you have to respond to every slight that may come along, because there's going to be a lot of them.
But he doesn't respond. A lot of times he creates the situation.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
He's an antagonist. He's king of the Twitter trolls, you know, even in this role.
Up. Right. But it's not, to me, it is not very presidential.
And what do you think about the amount of television he's clearly watching? You know, there are a lot of commentators that point out tweets from the president that seem to come mere moments after a story is aired on Fox and Friends, for example. Is it strange that this president watches as much television as he does?
Well, I guess it is. I mean, it is kind of, it's not unprecedented. I mean, you had Lyndon Johnson back in the day with in the Oval Office with three television sets. One, you know, they were running all the time with ABC, NBC, CBS. And, you know, he would watch them all at the same time, their news programs. And he was obsessed with it. And so is Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is definitely obsessed with his numbers, even though right. like this, it just seems like he's coming from the world of reality television where you might get the overnights, the ratings yes. after your show airs. And that's the way that he treats this job is this is a show. And mm-hmm. I'm the star of it. And what do the numbers look like this morning? How are we doing against the other shows that are on the air right now? Yeah. And it is the most watched show on television right now is the Trump administration.
It is.
I'd like to ask some questions comparing President Trump to Barack Obama, not necessarily on policy. And this may be superficial in nature, but I see questions asked about, you know, what if Obama dot, dot, dot? Can you imagine if Obama dot, dot, dot? And I guess I'll ask, what if Obama, dot, 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 I don't know, lied about how much money went to Puerto Rico or called out a network for not working for him anymore? Wouldn't the reaction be different?
I think it might be somewhat different, but I don't think it would be quite the way it is now. And I think some of his supporters would be appalled. You know, if he did that, because that was part of his persona, that he didn't do that sort of thing.
And that seems like a difference then, right? Because Donald Trump's supporters and even those who are holding elected office, you don't hear a lot of pushback about his behavior. Whereas I think you might have had President Obama engaged yes. in this because he didn't have a history of that type of behavior. Donald Trump was a known entity before he entered the White House. And Ken's back with us. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, is back with us.
Oh, good.
And I'll bring you into the conversation, Ken. We're basically talking about the what if Obama dot, dot, dot. And I bring it up because yesterday was the 5-year anniversary of the time Barack Obama wore a tan suit to a press briefing. And some of the...
Oh, no! Oh, my God.
And some of the conservative media really lost their minds about how unpresidential it was to wear a tan suit. And you think about some of the ways that Donald Trump has behaved since being in office. And I'm wondering, what do you think the difference is here, Ken?
Well, I think it is. I agree with you in the sense that Donald Trump has done so many things out of the norm that people don't get as outraged as they might have. Certainly, conservatives don't get as outraged. I mean, if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or anybody else did a tenth of what the president is doing or saying, there will be calls for impeachment. There will be calls for, you know, lining, you know, getting yes. the torches and lining the streets. And the fact is, the thought of Rick Perry being forced out of the presidential race because he couldn't think of the third cabinet agency that he would cut in the during a debate, and yet Donald Trump had Access Hollywood stuff and things he says about women and Muslims and Hispanics and the disabled. It's just. You know, they used to talk about Ronald Reagan being the Teflon president. I think it was Pat Schroeder of Colorado who gave him that title. But as much as Donald Trump's numbers have not moved either way beyond the 42% approval he gets, the fact that he says these things would have doomed any other politician, president or otherwise, and yet his supporters stick with him completely.
So what precedent is the president setting now? How will we view this office after Trump no longer occupies it, whether it's in 2021 or 2025? What is lasting impact?
You think he's going to leave office?
I have no comment on that, of course.
You truly think that Donald Trump will leave office?
He's pushed back on the idea that I think was first prominently floated by Bill Maher on HBO, who said that this guy won't leave willingly, but... You know, I think the Constitution expects a president to leave after losing election or serving two terms.
Yeah, well, I remember when Nixon was being pushed out and there were a lot of people who were afraid he wouldn't go and they'd have to send the army to go drag him out of the White House. But, you know, we'll see.
Michael, did you really cite the Constitution in Donald Trump's behavior? Yeah. I mean, I'm serious.
Well, sure.
Think of the emoluments clause about enriching himself with suggesting that his Doral Country Club should be the host of G7 or Attorney General William Barr having a party at the Trump International Hotel. Everything is benefiting this president financially, and everybody's saying, "Gee, I wonder if this is out of the ordinary."
Things are certainly out of the ordinary. This is an unusual presidency, no question about it. It's unorthodox in many ways. That's probably also a symptom of the access we all have to information and communication devices. It's just, you know, this is the first president who's serving in this highly connected age where that participates in it the way that he does. But let's talk about what you just referenced, Ken. We want to talk about the G7. How the president performed there, and then his idea that he would host the next G7 meeting at his own resort, which apparently has bed bugs in it. So we want to talk about his reaction to that as well. First, let me remind everyone that we do have a trivia question floating out there. We're going to take some calls on it here soon. Who was the longest Republican Senate leader, longest serving Republican Senate leader before Mitch McConnell broke that record? You can call us at 513-419-7100, and we'll get some answers here on the air very soon. So, Ken, talk about the president's performance at the G7. How does he truly look when he's on stage with the rest of the world leaders?
Well, he is sending mixed signals, and that's the thing that troubles the allies the most. I mean, the fact is, on one day he could call President Xi of China an enemy, and then literally a day and a half later saying he's a great friend and we're going to work some great things together. He sends separate signals about tariffs, whether he's going to go through them or not, and we're not going to have a deal with China. We will have a deal with China, and of course, how he feels about the environment and climate change as the Amazon is burning. I mean, there are leaders who are trying so hard not to offend him because they know that incurring Trump's wrath is not a good thing for them. But at the same time, they need to stay close to reality. So you have the president of France, you have even Boris Johnson of Britain, who has his own problems and own controversies. They are doing what they can to sound like somewhat supportive of Trump, but at the same time trying to make sense of what he's doing. And sometimes that's a very difficult task.
And what Ken has just described, is it any wonder that the markets have gone crazy and that there's so much uncertainty from one day to the next? What's the message? What's the message?
Well, it's strange to see the message that, you know, the president can send a tweet that tanks the market, in moments,
right,
and then tweet that everything is okay. So, I mean, he's even sending mixed signals to the public in a lot of respect. All right, let's get some answers to the trivia question on the air. We'll go to Alan. He's on the line. Hi, Alan. What's your answer to the trivia question?
Possibly Strom Thurmond.
Ken, is it Strom Thurmond?
Strom Thurmond was never the Republican leader in the Senate. He was the Senate President pro tem for being the longest serving Republican at the time, but he was never the Republican Senate leader.
Very good guess, Alan, but not the correct answer. 513-419-7100. Let's go to Rob. Rob's on the line. Hi, Rob. What's your answer?
I'm going to go with Mr. Speaks in third person, Bob Dole.
Bob Dole. Bob Dole.
Bob Dole. Bob Dole is the correct answer.
All right. There you go, Rob.
All right.
Ken, let's remind Rob what he's won.
He's won 2 years in Philadelphia. No, he's won a political junkie button. But also, just for the record, Mitch McConnell in 2018 surpassed Bob Dole's record of being leader 11 years, 5 months, and 10 days. Mitch McConnell broke that record in 2018. Before Bob Dole, it was, as you well remember, Charles McNary of Oregon, who was Wendell Willkie's running mate in 1940. I'm sure Charles McNary is on the tip of everybody's tongue today.
Yes.
All right. So our producer, Pete, will help Rob out and get that information. We'll get that political junkie button on over to your place. We got a tweet from Maggie that says we're engaging in Trump derangement syndrome. And this is something that you hear a lot when you talk about the president. And it's one of the difficulties of being a journalist in the age of Trump is that in this unorthodox presidency, how do you talk about it? And, you know, we had to go through this last month, too. We're not taking positions on the president's policies. It's more analysis of their impact and the behavior, I suppose.
Yeah, the style.
Okay, so we're.
I wish I had Maggie on the air though, because I've heard that from a lot of conservatives, and a lot of conservatives, as you point out, Michael, they are very happy with the president's policies on judges, on taxes, on foreign policy, even. But when we go after Trump, it's not because he's conservative or not following his promises.
No.
What he's doing is it's the dishonesty. It's the ignorance, it's the bullying, it's the anger, it's the personal attacks. I wish Maggie were on the air to talk about that, because I have no problem with Trump being a conservative. I don't care about that. I mean, look, he ran as a conservative and was elected as a conservative, and he's been a conservative president. But when he starts doing personal attacks and dehumanizing attacks and making things up, it's just...
This is the point that I was trying to get you to discuss earlier when I said, what if Obama ... And I'd have to wonder what Maggie would have to say if President Obama had engaged in the behavior of Trump. I would imagine that she'd be quite upset about it. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our full hour of national politics. We've got the political junkie Ken Rudin on the line. And in the studio with me is WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. You can join our conversation. 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or look us up on Facebook or Twitter. We'll find your comments and your tweets and get some of those into the show as well. We're going to talk about the Democratic primary in just a moment, but I want to make sure that we address some of the other stories that the president had to push back against. And one of those was that he does intend to have the next G7 summit at his place in Florida. And there were some reports that came out that there were bed bugs in this place. And so now he's had to go on the offensive, or even the defensive, right. I suppose,
yeah.
Saying that, no, my property doesn't have bed bugs. In the same stretch of days where he's had to push back against reports that he suggested to aides that maybe we should explore sending nuclear bombs into hurricanes as they approach the country's shores. And he's also floated the idea that maybe the United States should purchase Greenland from Denmark. And then he got into a high-profile international tiff with the leader of Denmark as well. So we got a comment from a caller who says we are spending a lot of time this hour on Trump's antics rather than substance. And I think that's a fair criticism.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, Ken... how do we sidestep some of these antics when they do impact a lot of either policy or narrative?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I will agree that some things like nuclear bombs into the hurricanes or defending the Doral against bedbugs, I could care less about that stuff, too. But when he says he wants to purchase Greenland, and that's fine, you could say that, and then the Prime Minister of Denmark says, well, that's absurd, and then he says, okay, I am canceling my state visit to Denmark because of her nasty comment about my suggested purchase of Greenland, this upends diplomatic relations with one of our top allies. So you can say, yeah, well, it's Trump being Trump, and, you know, who cares about personality? But these fits of pique are, I mean, look, we, you know, all the things you want to say about Nixon and Clinton and Obama and Bush and Reagan, there was so much to criticize, but some of this seems so irrational. And so, as I said, to go from China being the enemy one day to my best friend the next day, it is, of course, it's out of the ordinary, but it's more important than saying, oh my God, there goes Trump again. If it upends diplomatic relations with allies and the world doesn't know how to respond and the leaders of the world doesn't know how to respond, the role America once held under presidents good and bad alike are just completely changing and going off the charts.
And it's also that it all happens all at the same time. And within a 24-hour news cycle, you can suffer multiple bouts of whiplash, it seems like. Join our conversation. Let us know what you think. 513-419-7100. Let's go to the phones. We've got Maggie. Maggie's on the line. Hi, Maggie. How are you?
I'm fine. fine. How are y'all?
We're doing great. Good. Thanks for joining us. What's your question or comment?
Is this the same Maggie?
Hi, Howard. It is.
Oh, hi, Maggie.
Okay, so Maggie tweeted that we're engaging in Trump derangement syndrome, and did you want to elaborate on that?
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
Trump was not the first person to offer to buy Greenland, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's correct.
It was either Eisenhower or Truman for the same reason. It has strategic and mineral resources. It'd be very useful. Okay, that's one. Two, nobody cares about bed bugs at Mar-a-Lago. And the emollient cause, Ken, has been thrown out of two different courts now. So I think you all can put that one to rest. And to act like Lawrence O'Donnell was the first time a no-sourced or dimly-sourced story was put on the air trying to diminish or hurt the president is ridiculous. I mean, I read the transcript of the New York Times internal phone call, or I don't know what, internal staff meeting, and they flat said the newsroom had been set up to report the Russian influence on this administration, and now they were going to have to reset the newsroom. So you can pretend all you want that he's being treated fairly, and he's not.
Well, Maggie, I don't think anybody has said that the Lawrence O'Donnell thing was the only example of thinly sourced.
We talked about it in the context of this week.
Yeah, we talked about it in the context of what's happened just recently. Yes, there have been other stories like that. And yes, when that happens, it undermines all of the media.
And it was described in the context, Maggie, that this president says fake news so much on stories that are well-sourced and written by good journalists in good publications, regardless of what Trump supporters might think about these outlets. They're good, rigorous journalists. And so when a high-profile journalist makes the mistake that Lawrence O'Donnell does, then it does legitimize calls of fake news when they shouldn't be.
And people then forget about all the good, the well-researched, well-done stories.
And then the question about Greenland, just to reiterate that, what we're talking about in this context is not just that he made overtures to purchase it. It's that he then gets into an international situation with the leader of Denmark, and they were supposed to meet, and then he canceled the meeting. And I don't think the previous presidents who made overtures to Greenland behaved this way. I don't think that's deranged when you talk about the strange actions that the president has taken.
They did not cut off ties or try to, you know.
But Maggie, we want you to tweet at us and call us and hold us accountable all the time. And we do appreciate your call. We do have to run. Thanks for tweeting at us and calling us. We'll look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks for calling. 513-419-7100 is the number. Let's go to Jackie now. Hi, Jackie. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. I have kind of both a comment and a question.
Okay.
So I've spent the better part of the past 4 years kind of confounded by the whole Trump phenomena, which you're all discussing now. But what concerns me more, like, I actually believe, like, Trump's easy to identify, like, the psychology of him is that of, to me, a narcissist. So his behavior makes sense if you understand that disorder. However, what I don't get is how half the country can justify and support in front of a blind eye over and over to a lack of ethics, morality. I mean, I was an Obama supporter, but I could criticize him and call him out on the things that I didn't like. But I don't understand why there's no awareness on the other side with this. And what does that suggest about us moving forward as a culture, as a people, as a nation? It doesn't sit well with me when so many people can just seem to, you know, skirt these issues and find a reason for them or not, but accept it.
Jackie, we'll hang up and we'll take a shot at your question here. Thanks so much for the phone call. Ken, I'm assuming you heard Jackie's question there. And I'm wondering if the fact that, you know, even though there's been some discussions about a slowing economy approaching, right now things are pretty good. And do you think the fact that America's generally pretty good economically is playing a role in what Jackie's concerned about?
Well, no, I don't. And I'll tell you why I think. Because I think, first of all, I think the economy is doing not only pretty good, I think it's doing very good. There may be some signs up ahead about recession, and people have talked about that. But for the most part, unemployment is at record lows. I mean the job situation is very good. And Trump deserves credit. Did it start with Obama? Yes. But look, if the economy went sour, we would blame Trump. So the fact that the economy is good, we should credit Trump. But there's something else. There's an anger in this country that has not gone away since the Tea Party, you know, since Obama's election, shall we say, in 2008 and the rise of the Tea Party the following year. There's still an anger about jobs being taken over by them. It seems them, I put the word them in quotes, it seems to be a they versus we. I have to get my English, but us versus them feeling in this country that they are not true Americans. They are not out to save this, help this country. Only Trump is standing up for the forgotten Americans. Remember the silent majority under Richard Nixon. Donald Trump speaks for a lot of people who feels that they've been passed by this country. When same-sex marriage takes over and people say, well, wait a second, I'm not ready for this yet, Trump speaks for me. If there's fear about my gun being taken away, Trump speaks for me. So I don't know if it's half the country. It's certainly maybe 42% of the country. But the fact is, this doesn't surprise me at all. And I agree why people stay with him is because they just feel that the country and the world is not the way they envisioned it, not the way they expected it. Things are changing too fast, and Trump speaks up for that forgotten American.
All right. Well, 10 Democrats will talk on stage together about why they think they're the best candidate to take on President Trump in next year's election. We've got to take another short break, but we're going to talk about what it might look like with Bernie Sanders, Warren, and Joe Biden on stage together for the first time. And a little later after that, we're going to talk about Mitch McConnell possibly facing a popular media figure from the Democratic side in Kentucky's Senate election in 2020. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our full hour of national politics with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. He joins us on the line. And in the studio with me is WVXU senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. We're going to talk about the Democratic primary now. We want to hear from you as well. 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. So, gentlemen, we have 10 candidates on the stage for the next one. And before we dive into what these primary front runners might have to say to one another, I want to talk about Michael Bennett, the Colorado senator who is running for president but did not qualify for this debate. He said some remarks, and he said them right in front of the Democratic National Committee's leadership, and it was broadcast and got some heavy play on cable news outlets. But he said, Senator Bennett did, that the DNC's rules for qualifying for the debates are stifling debate in general and allowing basically popular candidates with large social media following to circumvent the others more easily. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Howard, we'll start with you.
Well, I think it's basically, I mean, we started out with 24 of these people, and there's only so long that you can do that. There's a natural weeding out process. People like Michael Bennett have contributed to the campaign. They've talked about issues. They've talked about issues that other candidates that do have the resources and do have the social media followings are also talking about. But, you know, I personally don't see anything wrong with the DNC's rules about who qualifies and who does not. I mean, you have to show some kind of support.
They had debates already that had a lower threshold to qualify, and more candidates did. So they spread them out over two nights with 20 candidates, basically split in half. And this happened twice. And so, Ken, each of these candidates, for the most part, nearly every candidate who was running on the Democratic side, got 6 hours of free national television. Is the fact that they don't have more support now kind of on them?
No, I don't. I really don't think so. And the reason I don't think so, look, I think weeding out has to be done, needs to be done. But I think it should take place in the caucuses and the primaries, Iowa and New Hampshire. Look, when Joe Biden ended his presidential campaign in 2008, it was the night of the Iowa caucuses when he got 1% of the vote in Iowa and he was out. But the fact is that they have to, if they don't make, I mean, the thought of, look, Kirsten Gillibrand, whatever you think of her as a candidate, and I think she had a lot of pluses, I think she had even more, a lot of faults. But having said that, the fact that she had to spend $1 million to woo voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, just so they will give her 2% in the polls so she can make the debates in September, seems like an unbelievable a waste of money, given the fact that many voters are not, they're paying attention to the campaign, but they haven't picked their choices yet. So to rule out a Steve Bullock, for example, why is this man, who's a social liberal, winning in red state of Montana? Why is he doing so well there? I would want to hear that, but he won't be in the debate in September. He probably won't make it in October either. So, but at the same time, look, Howard's right. You have 20 candidates. It's down to only 20. You have 20 candidates, and how do you put them on the stage? You can't. As it turns out, you will still have a debate stage of 10 candidates next month. But fortunately, because Tom Steyer didn't make it on the stage, it will only be one night. If he made the stage, it would have been two nights again. And I don't know if we want to see that again. But I don't think having 130,000 donors in August of 2019, 6 months before Iowa, New Hampshire, should be the criteria and the qualifications to keep them away from the debate stage. I don't know what's right, but this doesn't feel right.
Maybe this DNC series of debates was probably not the right thing to do. I mean, maybe we should have, as Ken suggested, let's weed this out in the early caucuses, in the early primaries, the way they always have. But we just got into the situation where I don't recall ever anything near two dozen candidates trying to
you
buy
had 16
for the same
Republicans in 2016.
Yeah,
that was
right.
a lot.
That was a
and
lot.
That was, the
that
record.
Was a bunch.
Right.
Right.
But isn't the primary system a little bit unfair as well? Because Iowa, New Hampshire, they're not really representative of the population
it is,
at
Michael,
large.
But it's all unfair. I mean, it really is. You know, how
What I like about Iowa and New Hampshire is that you don't have to have $100 gazillion to compete there.
Yeah, that
you
makes
could
sense.
You could be Jimmy Who. You know, you could be anybody. Look, Hillary Clinton was the front runner, but Barack Obama beat her in 2008 because he appealed to those voters. I think we're calculation putting in money but. I don't know.
I've been in both of those places, Iowa and New Hampshire, during the heat of the campaign. And the one good thing about it that always impressed me was that those people, particularly in New Hampshire, because it's such a small state, they expect to hear and meet these people and look them in the eye. And they're probably the best informed voters in this country.
But I wonder why that doesn't rotate. You know, why not Kentucky? You know, why not have them come get to know Kentucky one cycle and hear from voters?
I agree completely.
The only rotate. Remedy to that is, well, you could rotate or you could do a series of regional primary days.
Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, we do have 10 candidates that are going to be competing. So let's talk about the ones who did make it. And this is going to be the first time that we see the three that have been leading lately in the polls. Joe Biden, the former vice president, and then we also have Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. There are seven other candidates. I don't want to exclude them from our conversation, but this seems like pre-debate, this is the story. And Ken, what does it mean now that these three will appear together?
Well, it's the first time that Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren will be on the stage together, because in the June and July debates, they were separated. Look, I don't know what it means, because because remember, after the first debate, Kamala Harris was the story of the month. I mean, she got, because she stood up to Joe Biden on busing and segregation senators, everybody was talking about Kamala Harris. And then when she was attacked in the second debate for her, and she didn't have strong answers for it, then the story became Elizabeth Warren, who was very, very strong. I'm fascinated about what's the story with Joe Biden. Yes, he's leading in the national polls, but he has shown weakness. Look, this is not a national primary campaign. This is not a national debate. It's first it's Iowa, then it's New Hampshire, then it's Nevada, then it's South Carolina. In other words, these early state polls are what I really want to see. And if Joe Biden is showing weakness, and I thought he showed a lot of weakness in both the June and July debates, who will be the person who supplants him as the party frontrunner? Because the party is still wrestling with, do I want somebody who could beat Trump, or do I want somebody who gives a coherent message and speaks to my heart? And right now, there's not one candidate who fits that bill.
What candidate can possibly have a breakout moment at this point, Howard, because you've got a few others that are polling behind those three front runners who are looking for that Harris moment, who are looking to get that bounce that Harris got and then sort of relinquished after some pushback. What needs to happen for those candidates?
Well, unfortunately, probably they just need to go after Biden as hard as they can. And, they have to go after the guy at the top. And his message has been real simple, basically. I mean, basically he says, look, this Trump has been un-American. This is not the way we do things in this country, and we have to change, and we have to get rid of him. And he's leaving all the details. He said, we'll talk about that later. And, somebody is going to press him on real issues in this debate. I don't know who it's going to be yet, but somebody will. And then there's Bernie, who just seems to be kind of drifting along.
Yeah, it was interesting, since we're talking about polls a little bit too. And Ken, I'm sure you read this. Joe Biden is still comfortably atop the field in most of the polls. But a few days ago, this Monmouth poll.
National polls.
Right. Yes, national polls.
National.
The Monmouth poll comes out, and they're a pretty reputable polling firm. I think they got like an A-plus rating on, Nate Silver's 538, which rates the quality of the pollsters. But Monmouth came out with a poll that had Bernie and Elizabeth Warren tied at 20 and Biden at 19. And that showed like a 13-point drop for Joe Biden over a month. Monmouth came out with a statement after two subsequent polls from other high-quality firms came out that showed the race pretty stable, with Joe Biden significantly ahead nationally. What do you make of that?
Well, as in any cycle of polls, there are outliers. And even, as you say, the head of the Monmouth poll said, look, I don't know what to make of it. Sometimes numbers can just be skewed differently. And I don't know anybody who sees it that close. But again, polls are so interesting. The day of the election in 2016, everybody was convinced that the polls showed Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump, and that didn't happen. So I don't know what the value of the polls are, but the fact is that I think there's a difference between what the polls are showing about Joe Biden and what the feeling is down on the ground about the enthusiasm factor about Biden. So yeah. I think to me, the most fascinating story right now is Joe Biden. Will he be the nominee to take on Donald Trump? Should he be the nominee? And what do the voters in the early states have to say? Because there's a reason why his two previous, look, he's a different guy now after serving 8 years as vice vice president under Barack Obama. But unless he could say something other than Barack Obama, I think Joe Biden is going to have problems. But I don't know who's a better candidate. And that's, I guess that's why we need those debates.
And the polls did show Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump, but she did beat Donald Trump among the voters. So right. I think that's often forgotten, when people say that.
3 million votes, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about...
yeah, but they were illegal votes. They were illegal votes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right.
We do not endorse that comment, Ken. All right, so let's go.
From Neptune, all of them. Okay.
Let's visit my home state, the Bluegrass State, where Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is up for re-election next year. And I wanted to talk about him because just today, just early this morning, we found out in the Courier-Journal that popular Kentucky sports radio host, TV personality, and ESPN contributor Matt Jones is officially forming an exploratory committee to run in the Democratic primary to take on Mitch McConnell. Now, Amy McGrath, who unsuccessfully ran for Congress in the Lexington area last time around and got a lot of national attention for it, she's a Northern Kentucky native, went to Notre Dame Academy in Park Hill before going into the military. She and Matt Jones are already butting heads. So what we already have developing is this establishment candidate in McGrath going up against an unorthodox candidate in Matt Jones. Matt Jones was fired from his TV show because he's got a book coming out called Mitch Please about Senator McConnell. And what I want to talk about is, Ken, what do you think are the prospects for an unorthodox candidate, a personality like Matt Jones, and how will Mitch McConnell, who is not afraid to use his entire arsenal against an opponent, how does he react?
Well, I thought the only orthodox candidate was Jared Kushner. No, that's a stupid joke. Okay, we won't.
Make that joke.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know what's going to happen. I do know that Mitch McConnell is at the same time certainly the most powerful senator in the country and one of the most unpopular senators of anyone around the country. His numbers in Kentucky are not good, but the Democrats never seem to beat him. It is going to be a fascinating debate, just as Donald Trump was the outsider against Jeb Bush, the insider. The Washington Beltway establishment seems to have rallied behind Amy McGrath, and she has shown weakness as a candidate. She ran a good race against Andy Barr, but she has shown weakness. Matt Jones is like completely uninhibited. It'll be fascinating to watch him, but I don't know. It's going to be a great race to watch, but Mitch McConnell seems to find a way to win no matter what this Democratic primary. Look, this is probably the number one watched race in the country because Democrats, other than Donald Trump, would love to see Mitch McConnell get defeated more than anybody else.
And they haven't beaten him.
That's a tough task.
Six tries, he's won. But they have come close three times, half the time. They have come close. 84, his first time he won. 90 was close. And 2008 was also pretty close. Howard.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be just worth the price of admission to see Matt Jones going up against Mitch McConnell because I don't think Mitch has ever dealt with somebody.
That's kind of what I'm asking is like how is he going to deal with that?
He's never dealt with somebody like Matt Jones because there is no – there are very few politicians who come from the background that Matt Jones does and has the kind of following that he has.
He's the most popular Kentucky basketball commentator that there is, and that's the most. And he always presses Mitch McConnell on never identifying his true loyalty, whether it's to the University of Louisville or to the University of Kentucky. McConnell attended both.
He does it every day on the show.
Yeah. That's our show. We'll have some more to say next month. I'm sure there will be plenty more in the line. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, we always appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.